Welcome to the Naval Academy Museum's Warrior Writers Podcast. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, and this 14-part series will take you decade by decade, starting with the 1870s, discussing the personalities, technologies, and events that helped shape today's U.S. Navy. This podcast coincides with the Naval Academy Museum's exhibit, Warrior Writers, the U.S. Naval Institute, open from September 10th, 2015, through January 31st, 2016. Our guest for each episode leading us through the decades will be first Naval Academy History Professor Emeritus and noted historian Craig Simons, who is awarded the Samuel Eliot Morison Prize for his novel Neptune, The Allied Invasion of Europe and the D-Day Landing, and is also author of the upcoming book, A Concise History of the U.S. Navy. Craig will be followed by the director of the Naval Academy Museum, Claude Barrabe. Craig, we have reached the decade that for the 20th century just stands as a colossus right in the middle of it, and that, of course, is the 1940s. And that decade was dominated by the Second World War, and we're going to be on a little bit of a challenge to cover that in a 20-minute slot, but I think we'll be able to hit the bold-faced items. But before we get into the war specifically, is there anything in the years leading up to Pearl Harbor that we need to mention?
I think so. We mentioned last time when we talked about the 1930s that Franklin Roosevelt had decided to do as much as he could within the relatively narrow limits of the neutrality laws to support the British, and that included the neutrality patrols in the Atlantic. And very quickly in the early 1940s, 1940 and through 1941 before Pearl Harbor, that sort of morphed into a virtual naval war between the United States Navy and the German U-boats at sea. I mean, there were a number of cases when American destroyers cooperating with the British dropped depth charges on suspected U-boat positions. U-boats responded by firing torpedoes at American destroyers. Each side declared the other was the provocateur in this. It's pretty clear that Roosevelt was pushing the outside of the envelope pretty hard in giving support to the British in this shooting war, but undeclared war in the Atlantic. He was determined that he would force Hitler into a position when he would have to play his hand. Hitler was just as determined not to accept the provocations and go to war until the Russians were defeated. That was his main thing. Once the Russians were defeated, he had every intention of going after the Americans, but did not want to do both of those things at the same time. So there's already a naval war going on in the Atlantic before Pearl Harbor. I think that's something we need to be aware of. A second thing is that while the majority of the population in the United States remained determined that they would stay out of this war, the fall of France in the summer of 1940 was a galvanizing event for even the isolationists. They did not believe that this meant we should go to war, but it did mean that they recognized the possibility of a circumstance where with the defeat, the potential defeat of Britain, the United States would have to defend itself and its Atlantic moat against this new threat. And for that reason, there was near unanimous approval, in fact, literally unanimous approval in the House of Representatives for the biggest naval construction bill in the history of the United States. This is the famous Two Ocean Navy Act of 1940, came just a month after the fall of France. Billions of dollars at a time when $1 billion was still real money. Authorized the construction of 257 ships, almost doubling the size of the existing Navy. That included 18 brand new aircraft carriers, 7 battleships, 33 cruisers, and 115 destroyers. That bill alone created a Navy that would by itself have been the second or third largest Navy on the planet, not even counting the ships that already existed. So here are the two big events prior to Pearl Harbor that I think show, one, the United States already engaged in a war in the Atlantic and certainly preparing for a much bigger war with the passage of the Two Ocean Navy Act.
And at last, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor brought the United States into the war, and controversy has surrounded the events that led up to that attack ever since. What, in your view, explains the surprise in the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Well, let me first get out of the way a question that there may have been any kind of conspiracy here by political leaders, and particularly Franklin Roosevelt, who, so the conspiracy theorists like to say, knew about this and deliberately withheld information from Admiral Kimmel and General Short in Pearl Harbor. The record simply does not bear that out. It's a complicated tale where Roosevelt was, on the one hand, trying to push Hitler into a corner because he believes Hitler was dangerous to the survival of not only the United States, but democracy and freedom generally. But while he did that, he wanted to keep the Japanese at arm's length. He was trying not to provoke the Japanese, and was, I think, absolutely astonished when he learned that they had attacked Pearl Harbor. He would not have been astonished, I don't think, to find that they had attacked the Philippines. He would not have been astonished to know that the Japanese were invading the Kra Peninsula and Malaya and Borneo and certainly French Indochina and other locations in the southern Pacific Ocean. But he was stunned that they had managed to bring a naval task force all the way across the North Pacific to attack Pearl Harbor. So that was a surprise. But as you know, as we all know, Americans love conspiracy theories, everything from the assassinations of Lincoln and Kennedy to the contrived moon landing and a soundstage and so on. And I think it's not that Roosevelt was above acting duplicitously in order to get things that he wanted, but in this particular case, he was not a participant in a conspiracy to leave the Pacific Fleet hanging out on a limb, so to speak, and be attacked by the Japanese. He was a Navy man, had been all his life, loved the Navy. The idea that he would allow it to be attacked like that is absurd. And I think one of the reasons why these myths have persisted for so long is that it was hard for Americans at the time and ever since to appreciate that the Japanese had pulled this thing off. It was a remarkable accomplishment, logistically, technologically, and surprised us in a cultural way, too. I think the general American attitudes toward the Japanese, that they were Johnny-come-latelys technologically, that their airplanes were probably not as good as ours, their ships not as good as ours, their warriors not as good as ours, and it was a shock to find out that that was not the case.
What was the overall U.S. strategy in the war once we entered it after the attacks on Pearl Harbor?
Well, the United States obviously had considered the possibility of being in the war, had conducted a number of conferences with British leaders to determine a joint reaction should that circumstance come about. And despite the long-standing importance of Plan Orange to the Navy, that is the plan for the war against Japan, the contingency plan for the war against Japan, just prior to the war, just months prior to the war, a decision had been made and promulgated to all the services that because Hitler's Germany was by far a more dangerous enemy, had a larger gross domestic product, was a bigger, more efficient army, was more dangerous to our immediate allies, that the joint plan would be to defeat Germany first. The problem was that we didn't really do that. We actually fought a war against both Japan and Germany virtually simultaneously. We paid lip service to this idea of Germany first. George Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, certainly President Roosevelt and his chief advisors all tried very hard to keep the focus on Germany. The difficulty was that logistically, we simply were not prepared to take on Germany in 1942. There was some talk about it, that maybe we could have a contingency landing somewhere on the coast. We might try any number of things. But the fact was, we simply lacked the shipping, we lacked the trained army, we lacked the materiel. Then it would have been necessary to take on the Germans. At the same time, American planners wanted to make sure that the Japanese did not get a chance to consolidate their early victories. You know, the first 6 months of the war, they absolutely overwhelmed South Asia, taking over Burma and Thailand, all of the Dutch East Indies, the French Indochina, the Bismarck Archipelago. They conquered an area that, if you count the sea miles, was 10,000 square miles and nearly a third of the Earth's surface in a mere 5 months. And it would not be in American interest, so the argument went, to let them consolidate those holdings. So we actually went on the offensive much earlier in the Pacific than we had planned to, landing, as most people know, on Guadalcanal in August of 1942. And the offensives into the Atlantic theater began a couple of months later in November of 1942 with the landings in North Africa. So even though the plan was Germany first, in reality, the war was fought on two fronts virtually simultaneously.
And in the course of the war, obviously, there's so many, you know, high points and low points for the U.S., for its allies at land and at sea. But when you step back and look at the big picture from the Navy and Marine Corps point of view, what are those high and low pivot points or transition points that really stand out for you during the course of the war?
Well, I suppose two of them are the ones we just mentioned, and that is the offensive onto Guadalcanal Island and the Solomons in August of 1942, and the landings in North Africa in November of that year. The Guadalcanal campaign in particular began very small, a single Marine division going ashore to prevent the Japanese from completing an airfield. This is kind of what often referred to as a offensive defense. In other words, it was a defensive move to prevent the Japanese from finishing that airfield, which would have given them control over parts of the Coral Sea and that vital line of communication between Hawaii and Australia. And to prevent them, defensively, from completing that airfield, we had to seize that position with an offense that took the airstrip, subsequently renamed Henderson Field after a Marine pilot who was killed in the process. And the Japanese, deciding that they must respond to this, began to feed troops in. The United States added more troops, and what began as a relatively small undertaking soon increased into a major operation that lasted for more than a year and sucked in supplies and resources like a black hole, so that what began as a small event became a very large event. So I think the Guadalcanal campaign and the Solomon Islands campaign that followed that were crucial. It gave Americans a testing ground, the Marines in particular. It gave American ships an opportunity to find out what they could and, more importantly, perhaps could not do against the Japanese. It showed the Japanese superiority at night fighting. So there were lots of elements of the Guadalcanal and Solomon's campaign that were important. And in the Atlantic theater, the torch operation, similarly, the U.S. Army learned a lot of lessons in the campaigns in North Africa that they took subsequently into the campaigns in Europe. So those would be two. Now, for the Navy, there are a bunch, as you say, of these critical moments. Obviously, Midway stands out as a crucial battle. It was the last effort by the Japanese to exercise the strategic initiative. Their goal was to seize this atoll 1,100 miles north of Hawaii as bait to draw out the American carriers and then sink them in deep water, which would consolidate their control of the Pacific Ocean. It did not work the way they planned. A large reason for that was the code-breaking team at Station Hypo, led by Lieutenant Commander Joseph Rochefort, who broke just enough of the Japanese operational code to allow Nimitz to decide, in a very bold decision, that it would send out his two carriers and the patched-together Yorktown, surviving the Battle of the Coral Sea, out to confront the Japanese, three carriers against four. But, of course, the airstrip on Midway gave us a fourth landing site as well. And Midway was such an incredible story using Walter Lord's title, Incredible Victory, that it deserves it to stand in the forefront of high points for the United States Navy. Of course, it's only June 1942. We think of this as not quite midway, to use a pun, through the war. There are still many more years of war after Midway than there were before. So it doesn't begin the end, but it may be, as Churchill once said, the end of the beginning. So I would put Midway in there. The two other great fleet engagements of the Pacific War, the Battle of the Philippine Sea, which was connected to the landings on Saipan in the Marianas. The Japanese sent out their main battle fleet for that. The United States by then had developed an enormous battle fleet of 15 aircraft carriers, 900 airplanes, and simply overwhelmed the Japanese in the Battle of the Philippine Sea, which took place almost exclusively by air combat. I think the Japanese lost almost 400 airplanes that day, and more importantly, almost as many pilots, and they absolutely could not afford that. So what is sometimes called the Marianas Turkey Shooter, the Battle of the Philippine Sea, certainly belongs in the trilogy of great American victories in the Pacific. And lastly, of course, there's Leyte Gulf. Leyte Gulf remains today as the single largest naval engagement in history. It's very complex and very complicated, and oftentimes, passive students of the war just simply lump it all together as a big, complex battle. But it did have several discrete parts, the Battle off Samar, the Battle of Cape Engano, the Battle in San Bernardino Straits, and so on, that together and collectively made up an enormous naval engagement that saw pretty much the end of the Imperial Japanese Navy in the Battle of Leyte Gulf. Now, for the Marines, there are a number of high points as well and low points. We've already mentioned Guadalcanal, the extensive training ground, if you would, the Central Pacific Drive that began in the fall of 1943 at Tarawa was a low point in terms of the losses the Marines suffered in taking that tiny little island with so many casualties, over 1,000 killed. But it was also a training ground and for the Navy and the Marine Corps team in terms of the conduct of amphibious operations, and things went much more smoothly at Saipan. Not any easier, certainly, at Iwo Jima or Okinawa, but all of those together show that the Marines, having committed their energies and efforts to developing an amphibious doctrine in the 1920s and 1930s, certainly paid off here in the Central Pacific Drive. And I feel it behooves me to mention the Navy's role at D-Day. D-Day is often considered to be an army operation, and the soldiers who stormed the beaches, particularly Omaha, certainly deserve every credit we can give them. But let's not overlook the fact that they had to get there, and the Navy was much more than just a bus driver for that landing. The Navy combat demolition teams who took down the obstacles, the destroyers who provided close-in support, the battleships who provided long-range strategic support with naval gunfire, all of that was critical. And the Seabees, who followed in hard on the heels of the assault troops and built up the assets necessary to maintain that campaign. D-Day would not have been possible without the United States Navy, and for that matter, the Royal Navy. So all of these, and it's a lot, I think deserve, as you called it, bold-faced type in our history books.
And it's interesting that halfway through the decade is when World War II ends. But the period from 1945 to 1950 doesn't get much coverage. But it really is an interesting point when you consider the end of World War II, the huge fleet off of Tokyo Bay, both the old big gun Navy, the new carrier Navy, and over it all was the impending drawdown after the World War, which required some thinking, and Truman was very aggressive on the drawdown and what that saw our fleet become at the end of the decade. But also there was the military in general, but specifically the Navy's contemplating this new weapon, the nuclear bomb. How does this impact the projection of power at sea? What does this do with the Navy and its traditional mission, and trying to digest that? If you could take for a moment and talk about that post-World War II reassessment, not just what we need to keep of this huge fleet we developed in the Second World War, but that very real idea and discussion that did nuclear weapons make future battle fleets obsolete?
Sure. Three things right away. One is that there was a drawdown at the end of World War II, and of course there had been a drawdown at the end of every war in which the United States participated, back to the beginning of its history. I've said elsewhere that one of the ways you can assess the Navy's growth and contraction is almost like a sine wave. We build up for war, we contract afterward. But the contraction in 1945 to 1947 was less than in previous wars, and that's because the Cold War emerges almost immediately on the heels of the Second World War. So while there was a dramatic drawdown, it was not quite as dramatic as the one that took place following America's other wars. So the Navy remains very much a viable instrument in the half decade after 1945. Secondly, an important characteristic of this period is the reorganization of America's military. You know, we had fought throughout the Second World War, as we had fought all our previous wars, with the War Department and the Navy Department as two completely separate administrative entities. There was a Secretary of War and a Secretary of the Navy that both sat in the cabinet. They competed for resources, and they were more like allies than they were true partners sometimes in war. And that came to an, well, it didn't come to an end, but an effort to fix it was the 1947 National Security Act, which created the Department of Defense and made the Army, Navy, and brand new Air Force co-equal subordinate members of a single Department of Defense. That, of course, has emerged since then into our view today, where all of our operations, or nearly all of our operations, are joint operations. And we talk about purple suiters, that is, people who don't have as close a service affiliation as they do a national affiliation with America's defenses. So the 1947 NSA Act, I think, is crucial. And you mentioned atomic weaponry. This changes everything, of course, not only in the half decade after 1945, but up to and including today, as we struggle to ensure that Iran does not obtain a working nuclear weapon. One of the things that emerged in this half decade is that rivalry between the Navy and the Air Force as to who's going to be responsible for the delivery of nuclear weapons in a potential future war. The Air Force said, well, obviously it should be us. We're the ones who drop big bombs. We drop them on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We're our own country, We're our own service now, and therefore should have primary, if not exclusive, responsibility for the delivery of nuclear weapons. The Navy thought this was a terrible idea. First of all, they wanted to build oversized aircraft carriers that could launch airplanes that were nuclear capable of dropping a nuclear weapon. Eventually, of course, they would build submarines that would launch nuclear-tipped missiles. So the rivalry between the Navy and the Air Force about the responsibility for the exercise of a nuclear deterrent became so powerful that there was what historians call a revolt by the admirals in 1949, at the end of the decade, in protest of the construction of the B-36 long-range bomber for the Air Force at the expense of building a 60,000-ton large deck carrier, the USS United States. The CNO was actually cashiered as a result of his protests, but it did lead to a consideration, and out of that would emerge in time, and this is in future decades, what is often called a triad, that is shared responsibility to land-based missiles belonging to the Air Force, land-based airplanes belonging to the Air Force, but also those SSBNs, the boomers, the big Navy submarines that also carried nuclear-capable missiles as a triad of nuclear deterrence. So in the end, they figured out a way to share it after all.
And with that, the 1940s are drawn to a close. As always, been a pleasure, and look forward to talking to the 50s about you, Craig.
Thanks, Al. Talk to you next time.
Claude, just like the Second World War dominates any discussion of the 1940s, I think most people would assume that a museum dedicated to the United States Navy is going to have a significant collection from the Second World War, because not just of its role as establishing the U.S. Navy as the premier Navy, but just as its overall impact on the nation as a whole and its place in the modern world. What do we have there at the U.S. Naval Academy Museum from the World War II era? What are some of the highlights?
I think we have to remember that the museum was built just 2 years before the war started, and even a year before the war started, FDR is already suggesting that the museum expand because of its role as the only naval museum at that time. In the museum exhibit itself, on the first deck, is a chronology of the United States naval history, and about a quarter of that space is devoted, quite rightly, to the U.S. role, the U.S. Navy's and Marine Corps role in the Second World War. We really begin with items from the USS Panay, which was a gunboat in the Yangtze River protecting U.S. commercial ships in the middle of the war between Japan and China, and it was attacked and sunk by Japanese planes. Further along, we have obviously a large display on Pearl Harbor, where the ships were when they were attacked, and some lights to indicate how the flight patterns from the Japanese carriers were coming into Pearl Harbor. We also have a number of items from one of the midget subs, the officer's sword, weather vane, etc. We have a number of models that are built in our ship model shop, including the Arizona, which we have fitted out to be specific to the day before she was attacked. Further along, we have on loan from us from the National Security Agency Museum an Enigma machine, similar to one that was taken from the U-505 by Captain Dan Gallery and his ships. We have one of the original models that was used for the Iwo Jima Memorial that you can see now at Arlington National Cemetery. We have Japanese field artillery glasses that are about 70 pounds. We just did a documentary on these actually after some testing from midshipmen. And these were taken at the top of Mount Suribachi after the Battle of Iwo Jima. And finishing off our exhibit area is a case displaying the surrender of Japan aboard the USS Missouri. We have Admiral Nimitz fitted out in his uniform, his original khaki uniform worn that day. We have the original table, the original surrender cloth, one of the two pens that was used. And in fact, our treaty is a copy. However, when he came to the museum in 1960, he took one of the pens, signed his name, so that's actually his signature on this. For the exhibit itself, for the Warrior Writers exhibit, we have several items, including Nimitz's SDB jacket. We have we have sand from both Omaha Beach in Normandy as well as Iwo Jima. We have a class ring by one of the authors, and we have the prize essay medal by Lieutenant Franklin Percival, who was the only three-time winner of the general prize essay for Naval Institute proceedings. And of course, we have a poster, frame poster above, of the Sand Pebbles, the movie. And the reason we have that is because there was a chief petty officer, Richard McKenna, who wrote the 1948 Enlisted Essay Prize, the post-war CPO, sorry, the post-war chief petty officer. And McKenna had been a chief petty officer, obviously, and wrote the Sand Pebbles. So we thought it was appropriate to recognize his work, particularly since in this decade of the 1940s, we're starting to see more and more enlisted submitting articles. We had one in 1940, for example, a bosun mate who wrote on motor torpedo boats and their offensive and defensive operations.
As the war grew and continued to expand even before the U.S. became involved after Pearl Harbor, to the point that we had the fleet and the surrender at Tokyo Bay, what were some of the writers that really, you know, break to the front of the period for their ideas and their writings and how prescient their thoughts were?
Well, I mentioned Franklin Percival. He had been, he was a retired lieutenant by the time the war broke out. He had retired medically in the 1920s, but continued to contribute a great deal to the Navy in terms of his publications. He writes in his prize-winning April 1940 essay, A Threat and an Opportunity, calling for a surface fleet and air arm capable of waging a two-ocean war. And I think this is important because this, of course, gets FDR's attention as well as others. And this does become the title of Samuel Eliot Morison's seminal work on the history of the United States Navy operations during World War II. Another one we have is The Case for the Open Bridge by Lieutenant Sheldon Kinney. And Kinney, I think, is probably the most fascinating of the junior officers that we have represented in our exhibit on warrior writers. Kinney had enlisted in the Navy in 1935. He goes on to the Naval Academy, graduates in 1941, and just a few months after he graduates, his brother is serving aboard the USS Arizona, and he became entombed when the Arizona was attacked and sunk. Kinney goes on to serve on the USS Sturtevant in the North Atlantic. He was on it when she sank, and he survived by floating on a bag of coffee beans. He goes on in 1943 to command the USS Edsel, and at that time he was the youngest commanding officer of a destroyer-type ship in World War II from the United States Navy. Then serves on the USS Bronstein in the North Atlantic, sinking three U-boats, damaging a fourth. And after the war, several years later, becomes commandant of the Naval Academy Brigade of Midshipmen from 63 to 67, later president of SUNY Maritime. So he has a very distinguished career, not only during the war, but certainly afterward as well. So I think we see these lieutenants thinking about these issues even while the war is progressing. Another one, Lieutenant William Mack, goes on to write a number of articles himself in later years, writes about one of the battles against the Japanese to give people firsthand perspectives. In 1944, Lieutenant William Hessler, a Navy reservist, writes, "Sea Power in a Global War." So we're seeing things tactically as well as strategically, even, again, beginning at the beginning of the war, prior to the beginning in 1940, with a couple of authors talking about motor torpedo boats, in addition to the bosun's mate who had published something on it. We also see Ernest Eller becomes very well known as the director of naval history. In fact, there's a prize even today named after him. And he wrote his prize-winning essay on How Shall We Win in April 1942. And what his key thing was not necessarily platforms and operations win the battle or the war. It is the men in high responsibility and their character.
After World War II, we saw two big things like we discussed with Craig earlier. We saw the drawdown of that immense Navy fleet that came together in Tokyo Bay. And we also saw the intellectualization, the thinking of, the implication of this really unprecedented weapon, the nuclear weapon, not only what this new capability would have on what type of fleet you should have, but even what utility a fleet might be. In that post-war period from Tokyo Bay up to 1950, what are some things at the museum and in proceedings really kind of come to your mind for this period?
Well, sir, we do have a large camera that was used at Bikini Atoll. It's not currently on display. It's in storage temporarily. But we do have a number of other items. But with regard to proceedings, as early as October 1946, you have one writer, John Phillips Cranwell, who writes about Sea Power and the Atomic Bomb. And he suggests that following the bombing of Japan and the atomic bomb tests in the Pacific, he saw these new weapons as a challenge to sea power, not the end of sea power. So I think what we're starting to see is these naval officers and the civilians with whom the Navy is associated, how will they adapt in this new post-war era that's not simply a post-war era like the post-Civil War era, the post-Spanish-American War era. This is an entirely new era where nuclear power is a reality, and they need to jump on the bandwagon rather quickly. And as you know, in the late 40s, there was quite a debate between the Air Force with their proposed bomber, the Peacemaker, as well as the role of the Navy during this time. Who would take on the challenge of fighting a peer competitor in an atomic age? And I think the Navy did pretty well in making their case. Other items we saw: Rear Admiral James Holloway, whose son becomes the first commanding officer of the nuclear-powered USS Enterprise, writes his Holloway plan. on the procurement, post-war procurement of officers. As we discussed in a previous podcast, most of the officer corps in the first 40, 50 years of Naval Institute proceedings, or Naval existence of Naval Institute, most of them came from the Naval Academy. But here he is putting out a plan that says, no, we need people from the Naval Academy, NROTC, Naval Aviation College programs, unsubsidized NROTC students, and enlisted direct commissioning. So it's a very robust plan in that event. But we also see the Marine Corps taking a lead role, and very senior officers, people like General Alexander Vandegrift, who was a Medal of Honor recipient and the 18th Commandant of the Marine Corps. And in 1948, he writes about the Marine Corps, its appraisal, how it stood then, the impact to it via the National Security Act of 1947, and its future value. That it wasn't just about preparation. It had to be ready hour by hour. And I think we still see some of those elements today, that the Marines are often the first called.
And on that note, Claude, we bring the 1940s to a close, and we'll talk to you next week for the 1950s.
Great, thank you.